Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, I want to thank, as always, the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Hi, everybody. Good morning. It is the sort of number one rule of public speaking not to start with an apology, but I'm a well-known antinomian rule breaker. And that's kind of our topic anyway. So in sitting to try to figure out the entire flow of this five-part series, I realized that it's impossible to tell a story without the backstory. And so the reason I started with Shabbatai Tzvi is I think it's a critical element in understanding the transition between this sort of medieval and the modern world and the breakdown of so many of the structures that we touched on last week. Do a little review today, but now, like, istabachti, as we say. Like, now I'm in the midst of a story. The backstory is going to be bigger than the story, but don't worry. I have refined my focus that the goal really is to understand the origins of the Jewish Enlightenment. And the reason I think that that's important is, in many ways, the struggles that gave birth to the Jewish Enlightenment still characterize the Jewish world today. One of which that we'll begin to touch on today is, if the Torah is the best thing since sliced bread, then how come when the gates of the ghetto opened up, so many people chucked their tefillin in the Volga River and went to medical school? Meaning it's a question that so-called orthodoxy, which itself is a product of modernity, as we'll speak about, is not really prepared to engage. Which is it really true that freedom of conscience and thought are contradictory to the Torah? But that as soon as you give someone the freedom to explore and think as they will, that what it does is it pulls them away from the Torah. Is that intrinsically true? Right? And we're going to see, not today, but as we go forward, the tension around that question, some of the answers offered, some of the sort of retrograde motions, and a lot of really exciting stuff. So the big picture I want to do today is one of the parallel stories to Shabbatai Tzvi. We'll touch a little bit of review of Shabbatai Tzvi and the Sabbatean movement, just to make sure that we can bring that forward with us. Then I want to introduce Baruch Spinoza, who's a very important thinker both in the Jewish and in the non-Jewish world, someone who in many ways has been neglected in Jewish thought. Maybe we'll talk about a little bit why that is. Get Spinoza as one of our foundations for Jewish modernity, for the Jewish Enlightenment. Then I want to actually push a little bit specifically on what is Enlightenment, this sort of very loaded term in European history. And I haven't actually decided the last piece. We'll see what comes up at the end. Either to go into the Emden Eibschitz controversy, if you're familiar with it, or to just charge ahead into the story of Moses Mendelssohn. So we will see when we get there. You guys ready? Tov, let's do that. So just to put the pieces into play that we were speaking about last week, the model for the Jewish encounter with modernity, which I offered to you, shares one part of the classic encounter, which is the uncoupling of knowledge from tradition and the broadening of the horizons of thought, right? The world is much bigger. From the second that the globe has been circumnavigated and the edges of the map no longer say, you know, Darby dragons, right? There's a sense of a much bigger world. And furthermore, I want you to keep in mind that image for which Galileo was excommunicated, was, when you look into the telescope, don't tell me what you believe, tell me what you see, and then we'll talk about what you believe. In philosophy, that's called what? Empiricism, right? And the idea of empiricism, which is the driving sort of system of thought, if you will, behind what's known as the scientific revolution, which is really the precursor to the Enlightenment, is the idea that the sensory experience is the source of true knowledge. Right? If I hadn't have seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. And it's the root of experimental science. Now, interestingly enough, that will be what launches the modern era. But what launches the postmodern era is the idea that if I hadn't have believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. Right? This idea that one's belief system is not a neutral frame, but is actually a lens through which we view the world. I want you to keep that in mind as we go forward. Yeah, there's no way around it, right? The only way to do it is to keep that lens very clearly set in front of you and to ask the questions of what would it look like if I saw it otherwise, right? But nevertheless, we're not there yet. So empiricism as I pointed out to you, has a very strange relationship to the resurgence of the prophetic element within Kabbalistic Jewish mystical thought. Right? I mentioned that the Arizal, the great mystic teacher of Sfat at the late 16th century, returned experience to perhaps its rightful place, but certainly to a legitimate place as a source of knowledge, a source of authority, more importantly. Right? That classically, the Middle Ages has been characterized by tradition. Right? You've all seen Fiddler on the Roof, I'm sure. Right? This idea that we do what we do because it's what we've always done. And even if it's not what we've always done, there will be structures of authority that are the ones who adjudicate how to do it in a new way, which reflects at least the spirit of how we've always done it, right? Rabbinic authority is based on a mastery of tradition, right? But the mystic camp within Jewish thought is always hacking away at traditional authority. I mean, by the way, prophecy is almost intrinsically antinomian, right? Prophecy chips away at all law. Because, well, I'll just put it this way. Imagine you lived in the age of prophecy, right? If you haven't read my fiction book, I encourage you to pick it up if you want to know what it was like, right? And you had a choice. You're a good Israelite, and you want to know what God wants of you. You have two choices. There are some scrolls that are records of what it is that God wants from you. Assuming that you're literate, you could look there. Or there's the person down the street, man or woman, remembering that prophecy, of course, is an egalitarian pursuit, right? Who will tell you exactly what God has to say. Which one would you do? Exactly. I've never had anyone who tell me I'd go for the scrolls, please. Right? But the problem is that religion, is, of course, coincides with the end of prophecy and the rise of text. And text means that there is an authoritative structure of interpretation. An authoritative structure of interpretation means that there will also be a legitimate line of authoritative interpreters. We call them rabbis. Right, but as soon as the mystical tradition becomes to like come out from under the table here in the dark space of history, round about the expulsion from Spain, there becomes another way of looking at it, which is when the Arizal says, "I heard the voice from behind the pargod tell me that this is what we're going to do." Not only is that antinomian; it's chipping away at that whole authority structure. It's also empirical. Well, how do you know it's true? Well, I just told you how I know it, because I heard. Right, the voice of God is an empirical datum. I mean, whether you believe such a thing or not, that will get into the whole rationalist problem. We'll get there. Right. So understand that lying behind the Sabbatean revolution is basically Shabtai Tzvi's claim to be the Messiah. And how does he know he's the Messiah? Because he knows. And then along comes Nathan the prophet, as we spoke about, Nathan of Gaza, who's absolutely convinced that Shabtai Tzvi is indeed the Messiah. You can see it written on his forehead, right? And somehow they managed to sweep a huge portion of the religious world, and at that point of Am Yisrael, behind them. We spoke about the role that the conversos play in this, right? And experientially how their life was shaped by the end of that old model of identity, which had carried Am Yisrael through the entire Second Temple period, out through the first 1,000 years of exile, plus, right, up until, you know, basically the 15th, 14th century, which is that we are Jews and you are not. That identity model based on us and them. But now, the whole converso experience, we are them. They are us. And that idea of a model which is based on a clear separation between Jew and non-Jew, between permitted and forbidden, between right and wrong, even, is a tough sell. It's not a tough sell in theory, according to the traditional interpretation of text. It's a tough sell in experience. Because either, and some of you may relate to this, or you may know those who relate to it, either I have to condemn myself as an evil person, or I have to find some way of re-understanding not only myself, but the tradition within which I find myself embedded. This is a conversation I've had with many of my queer students who feel themselves with a deep allegiance to the Torah. You understand? I'll say it again. Either I have to condemn myself as an evil failure, misfit, etc., or I have to re-understand the tradition within which I find myself embedded. Right? That was the converso experience. And therefore, when Shabtai Tzvi came along and said, we've reached the end, and the sign that we've reached the end is that I'm going to lift up those sparks of God from the darkest bound places. Remember that blessing he made? Matir, not Asurim, but Isurim. Right? He, one who unleashes not the bound, but the forbidden. And will finally finish this process of bringing the light of God everywhere. So he struck a chord. Right? But he personally fails. We spoke about his, you know, let's say, loss of nerve. And don't forget, by the way, that if Shabtai Tzvi had chosen martyrdom instead of converting to Islam, I'm willing to bet that we would be celebrating him as an almost Messiah and not condemning him as a failed one. It's a tough sell, but he struck a very deep chord. And the chord that he struck was one of the biggest blows against the rabbinic establishment that history has seen. Because just imagine the day after. The bubble bursts. And everyone shows up in shul. I mean, obviously, it's not the computer age, so it takes a while for word to leak out. But as we pointed out, the whole advance of modernity of communication and transportation technology and the network of conversos and the merchants, where it meant that communication was actually quite quick. Just imagine, everyone shows up in the shul, and they say, "So, Rabbi, how about that Messiah? Where's his authority gone now?" Right? And all the enthusiasts have a choice to make. What's that choice? This may sound familiar. Either I have to condemn myself as a failure, sinner, etc., or I have to re-understand the tradition in which I'm embedded. And thus, the Sabbatean movement, we're not going to go to it now, but the Sabbatean movement will actually thrive after Shabtai Tzvi is gone. We spoke a little bit about the Cardozo brothers right at the end of class, if you recall. Avram Cardozo was probably the most famous of the Sabbatean prophets. They always had a pattern. First you're a Sabbatean prophet, right? Then you are sort of like a mystic master, and then you are the Messiah. It's like everybody ends up being the Messiah. It's actually a good deal, I think. So the Sabbatean movement won't really disappear from the explicit story of Am Yisrael well into the 18th century. And I haven't, like I said, I haven't decided whether we're going to come back with Emden Eibschitz. But I just want you to take away from this these two things. This converso consciousness, which poses the challenge, the empirical challenge. Either I'm wrong, evil, wicked, and most people are not willing to think of themselves that way. Or I must re-understand the tradition in which I am embedded. And you can see how that holds true with the Sabbateans. It's going to hold true by the intellectuals who begin to hear the challenges of the Enlightenment. It holds true for people today, whatever the identity issues that they face. That is a model which won't go away, which is why I think that converso consciousness is one of the hallmarks of that shift out of the sort of medieval era into the modern and postmodern world for Am Yisrael. There was a question. The model of authoritative interpretation and tradition.
Right. So,
I don't fit.
Right. I know that I'm Jewish, but I'm kind of an outcast from that system.
Well, I'm focused on the inner experience, meaning what you're pointing out is important. We're going to get to it with the story of Spinoza, meaning does my community accept me? But I'm actually, because as you can already see that one foot, at least in my mind, is in the postmodern era, I'm actually interested in the identity question, my inner experience, because I actually think that that's what matters going forward, because we're moving toward a world of individuality and freedom.
Okay, so Shabbatai Tzvi and the movement there, I'm sorry for jumping ahead, but it's almost like New Age Judaism, like, I can be Jewish by doing this and doing that and these other things.
So I said, well, once you open that model, in many ways, people will say that the Rizal, by returning experience to a legitimate place as a source of authority, and the converso experience by posing this question of either I condemn myself or I re-understand my tradition, will give birth to Shabtai Tzvi, Hasidut, the Reform movement, and Zionism. If you think about it, all of them will fit that model. And we will touch the ones that we get to in turn. Yes, many. There was a group, I mentioned them last week, called the Donmeh, who still exists today largely centered in Istanbul, who converted immediately in the wake of Shabtai Tzvi's conversion. They were the ones who said that this was the last step in redemption, where you have to sort of go all the way into what we would today call otherness, in order to redeem the sparks that are there, and believe that, that there's just a process of the revelation of the Messiah which is yet to come. Okay, so I want to sort of almost press a pause on that side of the story, but remember, it's bubbling, because simultaneous, and we've mentioned bits of it, simultaneous to the sort of internal Jewish story of Shabtai Tzvi, although I would point out that the Christian, so what's called the millenarial world, the Christian messianic world, was quite excited about him as well, but that's a story we just simply can't touch. There is this intellectual ferment within Europe and ultimately within Am Yisrael that is called first the scientific revolution and then the Enlightenment. And, you know, we mentioned empiricism, right, as this tool of the scientific revolution. If you're going to give a quote, by the way, for empiricism, probably the best one comes from Sir Isaac Newton, from the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, right, the Principia. He says, "I have not yet been able to discover the reason for these properties of gravity from phenomena." Meaning, he's sitting there under the tree, and the apple falls on his head. You've all seen the picture. And what's his realization? Something makes apples fall. I don't understand what, but I know for sure what goes up must come down. That's empiricism. And here's the key line. He says, "But I feign no hypothesis." Right? Meaning, you do not project your conceptual structure onto the world. The only way to get to knowledge, according to an empiricist, is to discard everything you thought you knew and start from the experience of your senses. Right? That's the empirical side, which is uncoupling knowledge from tradition. The other side of that coin, happening more or less simultaneous, right, is best represented by René Descartes. Descartes is the rationalist philosopher of European history. Right? And rationalism, as opposed to empiricism, offers reason and not experience as the foundation for knowledge. Right? There are certain truths that a rationalist sort of holds to be a part of our nature, and there are others which you can sort of grasp through what we call a rational process. And the tool of the rationalist is what? If the tool of the empiricist is experimentation, examination of the world, what's the tool of the rationalist? Wow, those are all, I would say, the secondary tools. What's their scalpel? Doubt. Their scalpel is doubt. Yes, it's true. Once you've cut away all falsehood with your doubt, then reason, logic, these are critical. But this is how Descartes, right? You know, what's Descartes' famous line? Right, but how did he get there? Right? How did he get to this whole, I think, or reality? You know, it's funny how we say these things, and we don't often think about it. And so he says in the Meditations, which is his great work, right, Meditations on First Philosophy, that true philosophy must begin with the discarding of any belief acquired from childhood until the present day. Interesting. That's called Cartesian doubt. Right? So he discards everything. It's a systematic process of questioning the truth of everything you ever knew. And anything anyone ever told you, right, philosophical, religious, even your sensory input, right? Because, of course, it's not so difficult to demonstrate that sensory input is a subjective experience, right? For instance, what color is this? You all said white, but the answer is even beyond what light it's in. Says who? That's your subjective experience of it, but oh, the scientists will talk to you about, what light it absorbs and what light it reflects, but then all the challenges of the framework come in. So a real skeptical rationalist, I should say, right, discards everything. And that's why he ends up with the one thing he can't get rid of, which is what? There's a me asking this question. I think, therefore I am. Because there is a mental pattern which is doubting everything which underlies all of the assumptions. Now, this is, like, really moving, and I'm sure some of you have been there at certain moments in your life, but I want to remind those of us who have been together for a little while of Rav Sajagon's epistemology. Rav Sajagon was the first thinker, and we're talking about the 10th century, he was the Gaon in Sura in around 929. He was the first Jewish thinker to attempt to integrate philosophy and religion. Right? He was the one who sort of he was the champion of that great Arabic notion that there are two paths to one truth, reason and revelation. Right? And in the introduction to his book, Emunot V'Deot, Beliefs and Opinions, he offers what we call an epistemology, a science of knowledge. He says that there are four sources of right knowledge. There's sensory input, the empirical, right? There is learned knowledge, what's called direct intellectual apprehension, right? And then there's logical deduction. You don't have to actually see the fire. You can see the smoke, meaning there are ways in which to use logic to learn. Those are the three, which are largely empirical. The third is, anybody remember? The fourth, thank you. No, I remember what I just said. Is authentic tradition.
This is revelation?
Yes, according to Rav Sajid, this is revelation. Because he says the Torah is like a letter you can trust. Sajid Gaon? Rav Sajid Gaon, at the risk of you know, the sort of self-promotion, I would check out the podcast on him. He is perhaps one of the most important thinkers of Jewish history. So what we're looking at now in the uncoupling of knowledge from tradition is the erasure of that last pillar of epistemology, meaning there is no such thing as authentic tradition any longer in the minds of the moderns, right? And this is going to be the battleground out of which the Jewish Enlightenment is born. Because on one hand, is it meaningful to be a Jew without some claim to authentic tradition? On the other hand, how can you claim authentic tradition in the face of all the challenges which lie ahead of us? So the first person to really grapple with that question is going to be Baruch Spinoza. Spinoza, is there anything else from Descartes I want? Oh, the last thing is that Descartes also represents a very important shift in European thought about religion. It's not just what we call Cartesian skepticism, right? His willingness to doubt everything as a basis for knowledge is that if you're going to doubt everything, what else do you have to doubt? God. Well, belief in self was the place that he didn't go because there's a me asking the question. That's I think, therefore I am. He tried to go there, but he said, if I'm going to doubt my own existence, who's the I doubting my existence? And that's where he starts, right? But you have to doubt God for sure. Certainly anything you've ever been told about God. So the question is Descartes an atheist? Now today, being an atheist is nothing surprising, right? But in 16th century Europe, not only was it surprising, it was potentially fatal, right? Meaning it was illegal and certainly potentially fatal if the word got out in the wrong circles. And so what I would say is that, let's remember that a theist is a belief in God as something or someone or a being who exists outside of the universe as we know it. Meaning that there's an interaction between creation and creator. We'll touch a little bit more on why that's important as we get to the end of Spinoza's story. Right? And in Europe, in the 16th, 17th century, a theist meant belief in the God of the Bible, which is a little bit easier to understand, right? I mean, we just came through Pesach, right? Why is it that, when we're coming up to Shavuot, why is it that the Ten Commandments start with Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiti Etchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim? Why I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, and not what might have been the more obvious, I'm the Lord your God who did what? Created existence, right? Why?
He's involved in all.
Which is ultimately harder to buy and much more impressive. Meaning, the idea of God as creator of existence, at this point, even the physicists are like, well, something had to start it, you know. But the idea of God who's micromanaging post facto is actually a much bigger stretch. It's a much bigger stretch. And therefore, the relationship which is offered at Sinai is a relationship with the God who both knows and cares about what you do, and will punish you for your wrongdoing. So sorry about that. It's old school slipping out there. No. So in Europe, the idea of theism is the belief in a particular God who communicates with humanity through revelation and intervenes in history through miracle. This should sound as no surprise to the Jews, but we've been having a long-standing Jewish-Christian debate about whose God is bigger, basically for the last 1,500 years. So Descartes, in his skepticism, gives sort of the, his, perhaps we could say the origin, if not one of the origins, to what becomes known as deism. Because as empiricism and, you know, the empirical approach to the existence of God, we call what? Either atheism or prophecy. Remember, empiricism is about using the sensory input as a source of knowledge. So either if you look in the world and you don't see God at all, then God doesn't exist. Right? But if you are hearing the voice of God speak to you, you are, well, either crazy or a prophet, right? And this is why we're going to see a simultaneous rise of Chassidut on one side of the European Jewry, and first deism, then ultimately atheism on the other. Because that's that empirical element. And the rational element will always try to negotiate between the two, and God willing, we will get to the person of Moses Mendelssohn, who is the person who actually tries to do that. As much as Mendelssohn is painted by the sort of later Orthodox world as the sort of source of all Jewish heresy, it's a misunderstanding. Mendelssohn was the person who tried to hold the rope at both ends. It was a question there? No, it was just, oh, okay. Okay, you can stretch. I just don't want to miss the question. Okay, so what Descartes really helps to birth into European society is what's known as deism, which is that deists believe that both nature, meaning empiricism, you can look at the world, and reason do indeed indicate that there was a creator of the world. But what they also indicate is that creator of the world doesn't alter the original plan. This is what's known, maybe you guys remember some from your education previously, is the watchmaker God. Right? The idea that God put the world together in a very, and that's why as an empirical, what's called the argument from design, you look at the world, I'm sure you guys have heard this before, like if I stand up and say, this cup, did it create itself? Everyone says, certainly not. And I say, how do you know? Well, look at it. It's like pink. It's got the lines. It's like, things don't make themselves like that. I say, oh, so if this cup didn't make itself, how could you believe that the human body or that nature created itself? If this cup has to have a designer, so does the world. It's called the argument from design. We're not going to get into whether it's a good argument or not. It's certainly an old one. So that's one side of the argument, right? So that's how you could look into the world and see God. The other rationalist side simply says, well, if you don't believe the world has always existed, it had to start somewhere, which means it's a beginning. Get into the argument is not so critical. The key is, what have you done is you're allowed to hold on to the idea of God, but what have you let go of? Involvement and therefore interaction, therefore any relationship, and furthermore, whether people are really interested, let's face it, any authoritative demands. Meaning, what's the basis for morality and certainly commanded behavior if there is no relationship available to God? Now, if you're familiar with a little bit of European history, what steps into the gap in the meantime? What were the Enlightenment philosophers enamored of as a source of morality? It's called natural law. The idea that the world actually does have a harmonious way of being, and that the source of morality and proper behavior is natural law. By the way, how does the American Declaration of Independence begin? We hold these truths to be to whom? Right? It might have been self-evident, a bunch of rich, white, landholding, you know, sort of patricians living in the Northeast, but I don't think that the average African kidnapped and sold into slavery felt that those truths were so self-evident. Yes, they were all deists. Not all of them, but that was a significant part of their intellectual heritage. Social contract is an attempt to basically create a social construct that can solve this problem, which is that there is no overarching law or being, but if we all agree, then that itself is enough. I mean, that's an oversimplification of it, but you're correct in identifying the problem to which it's responding. Okay, so this is all sort of in the intellectual mix, but for most of the Jews in Europe, Shabbatai Tzvi is much more interesting, and certainly is on their sort of frequency. When they tune into reality, let's remember, it's not the information age, right? So they don't actually, they're not so familiar, Jews aren't reading Descartes, right? They're not, certainly most of them can't read what language? Latin. right? And so therefore, most of the intellectual discourse of the day is unavailable to them, right? But, you know, there is one place in Jewish culture in Europe which is very unique, and it's the city of Amsterdam. The city of Amsterdam has a fascinating history in its own right. The history of the Jews of Amsterdam deserves a deep exploration and examination. For our purpose, we need to know a few things. First of all, legendarily, Amsterdam is a city of tolerance, right? What's known as the Treaty of Utrecht, which I'm sure I'm saying wrong. Somebody have it? How do you say it? Okay, I said close enough. As we say, good enough for government work, right? So there's a whole, there's what's called the Union of Utrecht, right? And the 13th article, right, which helped to bring the Republic into being, that union, promised every individual should remain free in his religion and no man should be molested or questioned on the subject of divine worship, right? Today, again, it's self-evident in sort of Western liberal democratic culture, but this is where it began. And it began, by the way, didn't apply to the Jews. Who were they speaking about? The Protestants and the Catholics, right? And this was a product of that same momentum that the Treaty of Westphalia, which was only in 1648, it's not so far in our background here, it's actually current, decided that the attempt to create a unified stance between religion and state will lead to perpetual war. And so one of the hallmarks of the birth of modernity was not just the uncoupling of knowledge from tradition, it was the uncoupling of religion from power. Right? And that, by the way, created the secular state, as I pointed out to you. As soon as you have a state which is able to stand above the religion of its individuals, you've empowered a state above religion at all. So on one hand, there's tolerance, because that means you can have Protestant, Catholic, and ultimately Jewish citizens of a state. The state doesn't have a particular religion. On the other hand, it begs the question of what is it that gives a state legitimacy? Historically, from Augustine in the 4th century all the way through the Treaty of Westphalia, what gave a state legitimacy was religion, right? Divine right monarchy and all its manifestations. And one of the big challenges, by the way, ad hayom hazeh, to this very day, is what gives a state legitimacy? So there's two answers, by the way, in our postmodern world. Do you know what they are? What gives a state legitimacy today? The power and the people. You guys got them right away. Very good. Meaning, we see states legitimate insofar as there's consent of the governed, which means, in our language, broad granting of civil rights to individuals regardless of, you know, class, creed, race, or religion. Or we look at the world and we say, well, you know what gives a state legitimacy? Power. Which, as we know, usually comes together with what? Curtailing all the things that we just labeled, right? That split hasn't come yet. In fact, we're going to see a very interesting phenomenon of the Enlightenment called enlightened despotism, where it's going to be power in the service of citizenship, right? But for right now, Amsterdam is a unique environment. It's not just a uniquely tolerant city because of the Union of Utrecht, right? It's also, of course, a commercial hub, which intrinsically commercial hubs are more tolerant because it's good for business when you have more types of people around, right? We're not going to get into the whole exploration of the New World and the creation of what we now call multinational corporations, the way the Dutch East Indies, Dutch West Indies, if guys have some sort of knowledge of world history. But the Jews, and in particular, the conversos, either the actual Sephardim who fled the Iberian Peninsula or the conversos who were forcibly converted and then eventually got out, will find a home in Amsterdam. And their commercial networks and their connections, particularly in the New World, where many of them fled as well, but also throughout the East and through the traditional Jewish communities of Europe, will give them a tremendous amount of economic power. And with economic power comes freedom. If anybody here ever toured Amsterdam, right, there's some of the famous synagogues and incredible mansions of what are known as the Port Jews, right? At another time, maybe if you corner me, we'll do a lecture series on the Port Jews and the Court Jews. Right? In many ways, the Port Jews are, within largely the Sephardic world, the commercial magnates who through their network and, of course, that Jewish business brain, right, managed to rise to power within Christian society. But they're not like the Court Jews of the more sort of central Western Europe model who rise to power through their intimate relationship with absolute power. Right? And therefore, they become what are known as the Shtadlanim. They become the intercessors between power and the larger Jewish community. But these are two sort of entrees into modernity for a small but significant part of the Jewish people. And they will create a model that in the end breaks down a lot of the traditional structures and opens the way for, let's just say, unbounded behavior. So Amsterdam is a hub for that city of tolerance, networked city, commercial city. It's also a hotbed of Sabbateanism. I'm just going to keep that story on the side, right? Even from the beginning, for all the reasons I just named, right? It was a place where Sabbateanism could both find initial reception when Sabbatai Tzvi himself was still alive, and then would have a long afterlife, even after he was gone. But for our purpose right now, Amsterdam was unique in Jewish history because the community as we see it, now we're speaking about the mid-17th century, we'll call it, you know, well, Spinoza is born in 1632, is probably the only time in history, but certainly time at this point for the first time in history, largely made up of ex-Christians. The vast majority of the community of Amsterdam at this point is made up of former Christians, which is interesting culturally. Because on one hand, you would think that would lend itself to a sort of a broad-minded understanding of human experience. But if you think that, you know what you don't understand? Communal psychology, right? Because it also could lend itself to what? A deeply reactionary stance toward anything which deviates from communal norms. And that's unfortunately much more indicative of our story. So Baruch Spinoza's father had come to the city in 1627, which is pretty early for the history of the Jewish community. Successful merchant, upstanding member of the shul, supporter of the Talmud Torah. Right, the Talmud Torah there is famous for its own reasons. We can't tell the story of Menashe ben Israel, but he's another very important figure in early modernity. There'll be a plug for next year. Baruch was the youngest son, by most accounts exceedingly bright. His teachers included Menashe ben Israel. You know, it's a question whether he was ever really intended for the rabbinate or if that isn't just a classic Enlightenment trope. Right? I mean, this is a trope that you will hear, especially when you get into the Eastern European Enlightenment. He was so bright, he was going to be a rabbi until he started reading those books and he went off the derech, right? This, by the way, relates to another piece of our story, which is always a challenge in learning and teaching history, which is called the history of reception, right? I mean, Baruch Spinoza was a real person who had an impact in his day. But as soon as he was gone, or even while he was alive, you encounter a secondary phenomenon, which is what did he mean to the people who heard about him? Right, and that's what's called the history of reception. How was the personality and the idea of who Spinoza was received by people after him? So when you read 19th century Jewish historians, which is really the beginning of Jewish history in the formal academic sense, you're encountering Spinoza as they wanted him to be. Not that they were deliberately falsifying, that's not my point, but to people who had done such internal and communal efforts to free themselves, Spinoza was a shining light. At the same time, right, Spinoza is, to the religious world, the archetypical heretic. I mean, just get this. Right, this wasn't discovered until fairly recently within the Pinkas, the diaries of the community of Amsterdam. The senores of the Mahamad of the Portuguese nation in Amsterdam, having long known of the evil opinions and acts of Baruch de Spinoza, daily receiving more and more serious information about the abominable heresies which he practiced and about his monstrous deeds, have decided that the said Spinoza should be excommunicated and expelled from the people of Israel. I could go on. Cursed be he by day, cursed be he by night, cursed be he who lies down, cursed when he rises up, cursed. It goes on, by the way. It's actually one of the most serious. We have many records of excommunication. It was I wouldn't say common, but it was a known tool for communal discipline within all of European Jewry at the time, right? And most of them don't touch this one. This is wrath. Wrath, communal wrath. And the question is, what on earth were the abominable heresies and monstrous deeds of Baruch de Spinoza? Right? So, yeah, you know, don't tell.
How many such excommunications were there in that community?
I don't have the numbers. I mean, truth is, it's a number that's out there. I just don't have them with me. There are a number of really good books out there on Spinoza, some of them written recently. If you guys send me an email, I can send you some references. But what I'll tell you is that about 15 years before Spinoza began his journey into heresy, a young man named Uriel da Costa committed suicide. Right? Now, Uriel da Costa, most people, I see some people nodding because you guys are more knowledgeable than the average crowd, but most people, and certainly in his day, hadn't heard of him. Who was Uriel da Costa? Uriel da Costa was a converso who, while in, if I'm not mistaken, while in actually in Spain, had been studying within the priesthood, held some minor office within the church, and had basically, in encountering the Bible, started to say, hey, I think the Jews are right. And then in uncovering his own ancestry, he said, hey, I think we're Jews. And convinced part of his family to flee with him. It's a story which repeats itself, sadly, through much of the period. But da Costa, when he came to Amsterdam, enamored of the biblical, passionate presentation of the relationship between God and Israel, and seeking to flee the oppressive regime of the church, what did he encounter when he got there? Rabbinic Judaism and communal stricture. And he was unable to adapt. Now I want to tell da Costa's story, but da Costa ran head on to those two things. Rabbinic Judaism, which he knew nothing about, which is, even if one believes it to be a direct reflection of the will of God, is a much more intensive system than what the Bible presents itself as. And therefore, it's a big ask, right? And he encountered a community which had, in many ways, on one hand, the most liberal, sort of free and open culture they were embedded in, at the same time, had a lot of issues with people who weren't willing to toe the line, because it's a thin line between Christianity and Judaism in their minds, and they were fighting a battle internally to reestablish themselves individually and communally as part of the Jewish people. And remember, many of them still had relatives who were either practicing Christians or were sort of like survivors of the conversion process, who were in a gray zone, etc. There's the most mixed community. Today, we're much more familiar with these phenomena. But then, this was fairly unique. And so da Costa was brought to heel by the community. At a certain point, not only did they put him in, they threatened him with excommunication, but the story is that they forced him to lay down on the threshold of the synagogue, and all the members of the shul stepped on him as they walked in order to break his will to the community, and he couldn't handle it, right? The story is that he took two pistols, he went and he shot one of his relatives, I think his cousin, if I'm not mistaken, and then himself, and after several days of terrible suffering, died. Da Costa couldn't handle the transition between the life of a converso, for whom hope is what it means to be a Jew, hope and freedom, to the life of what was offered to him, which was that obedience is what it means to be a Jew. And in doing so, he killed himself. Spinoza will see, actually, when he encountered the same problem, chose to kill God.
So that's a great
question. It's hard for me to give a comprehensive answer on whether, how did the community use excommunication? Was it for the loudmouths, or was it for people who weren't willing to show up in shul? That's an interesting subject for sociological research. But I would say my general knowledge is such that people don't rock the boat, don't get excommunicated. I mean, there's always been the guy or the section of the community that doesn't show up to shul, that people say, I don't really eat in his house, or whatever the questions are. But they're not affecting the communal fabric. That's human psychology, right? And a person who has a kind heart accepts it for what it is. A person who has a judgmental heart can be judgmental, but it's not threatening to the community. In many ways, there's a way we can strengthen ourselves. Spinoza, well, that's our question. What is it that he did? So at around age 20, Spinoza's father, which as I mentioned was a wealthy merchant, decided that he needed to have a proper education beyond the yeshiva, which is, again, another one of the hallmarks of modernity that we're going to encounter again and again. It's this idea, which is leaking in from general European culture, that it's not enough just to know the Torah. You have to know general knowledge. And I don't, by the way, when I say leaking in from European culture, you can find sources for that in the Jewish canon as well. It's a long-standing argument about whether one can even understand the Torah without having sort of like general scientific and even perhaps philosophical knowledge. Maimonides, the Rambam, is of course the great advocate that all knowledge is knowledge of God, right? But at the same time, this idea of what's known as dat chitzoni, some sort of external consciousness, or what's known as chochmat yavan, right? Greek wisdom, also has a deep root that the fact of the matter is, and I go back to my opening question, right? How many people have encountered external knowledge in Greek wisdom and decided that the Torah is a bunch of hooey, I'm going to medical school, right? And so that question is an important question. But somehow, Spinoza's father felt that it was okay. We'll see how that ended, right? And Spinoza began studying Latin with Francis van de Enden. He was a former Jesuit priest. By the way, studying Latin because that's what you had to know in order to know the secular knowledge of the day. He was a former Jesuit priest, emphasis on former, apparently a notorious free thinker, known as a radical Democrat, small d, right? And by the 1660s, he was considered both a Cartesian and an atheist. As I pointed out to you, the line between those two was a little bit fuzzy. And his books, of course, had the distinction, he'd written some books, of being placed on what's known as the Catholic Index of banned books. Right? That's the who's who of heretics. Right? You get your book on there, you're made. Right? At least, I mean, you know what I mean. So so there are many people who believe that it was... What? Oh, sure, so does the Inquisition. No, I don't think so. No, not as an office of the church. You can look into that. It's on the shelf, ready to be dusted off at any time. Okay, so you can check me on that. I could be wrong. I'm always happy to be wrong, especially when you let me know. It seems, and like I said, we have a very fuzzy notion of his early education and what really he was doing, but it seems that this was his entree, and he becomes ultimately one of the more important Cartesian philosophers in Europe. His great his first entrance into the philosophical discourse was a synthesis and a representation of Descartes' rationalism that he called The Principles of Philosophy, René Descartes, demonstrated according to the geometric method. It's what brought him to fame amongst philosophers, if there is such a thing, right? That comes later, though. So that was one influence. The other influence, it seems, was a man named Juan de Prado. Now, de Prado was a new Christian. He was a teacher on the faculty of medicine at, so funny in my notes, it says Toledo University, but it means the University of Toledo. I come from Ohio, so I see that. I'm like, oh, Toledo University. Juan de Prado. But he wasn't just a new Christian of good standing and on the faculty there. He was an enthusiastic Judaizer, right? He organized student groups in the university, taught them whatever they could about what it meant to be a Jew. He was the leader of an underground. Now, eventually, the Inquisition got wind of his activities, and he managed to escape the Iberian Peninsula with his life, which, of course, not everybody did. And again, like I said to you, if you study the history, this is a common trope. Now, here's the thing. And by the way, in the Registry of the Amsterdam Community, Prado's name appears in October of 1655, right? About 15 years after Oriol de Costa had taken his own life. Now, here's the challenge. That in Spain, being a Jew had meant the exciting life of the underground, right? Conversos fighting for their existence, for their freedom of consciousness, sharing faith, inspiration, you know? In Amsterdam, it meant the rules and the communal norms. And here's a person who had devoted his entire life to freedom of thought, being told, you can't say that, which isn't going to end well. It's interesting that he had a friend who was a very important member of the Jewish community who ultimately became his opponent, Baltasar Orobio, who wrote the following, and it kind of says it all. It is only to you that it so happened to be a fake Christian and a true Jew where you couldn't be a Jew, and to be a fake Jew where you could truly be Jewish. Yeah. You understand? Is that this is the rabbinic model that we've spoken about at time and again, a one-to-one relationship between law and identity. To be a true Jew at this point means you keep the law. But to people like Juan de Prado, to be a true Jew meant that you were devoted to being a Jew. How that found its expression in his world was secondary. Why? Because he couldn't control his external circumstance. He hadn't had the knowledge, and the church was breathing down his neck. But to be a Jew meant a counterculture movement. Right? Which, by the way, isn't just a cultural phenomenon of the Converso movement. Since Abraham, who was, of course, the original Ivri, right? Ivri meaning he stood on one side, as the Midrash says, and the whole world stood on the other. To be a Jew is a counterculture stance. Just try to imagine Avraham looking at the whole world and saying, oh, you're wrong. Yeah, this whole idol thing, nah. The only thing, by the way, I've ever been able to compare to in my own mind, this what I call conceptual courage, is Einstein, actually, another good Jew for that respect. Just imagine Einstein, right? Everyone's saying matter, energy, and never the two shall meet. And he says, you're wrong. You know, so the Plato wasn't just a sociological product of his day who wasn't able to get into the mold of what a Jew really was. He was a problematic element of Jewish history that popped up at a time when the structures of tradition were already being undermined. Right? He's a reflection, on one hand, of what a Jew absolutely is, which is a counterculture movement. On the other hand, without the vessel to actually channel that toward anything constructive, because his whole posture was anti. And so his reintroduction to the community, let's just say, was less than smooth. And when trying to piece together, and he, by the way, became a friend and mentor to Spinoza. He was excommunicated more or less at the same time, I think slightly before, although he could have been slightly afterwards. It doesn't really matter, that one. But it's interesting that in the archives of the Inquisition in the 1950s, they still have an archive at least, there was discovered a report from Brother Tomas Solano y Robles, who had traveled through Amsterdam in 1658, snooping on the conversos, because remember, the church was still attempting to persecute any Christian who had broken away from the church. He reported having met Spinoza and Juan de Prado after their excommunication. And they told him that they had been observant of Jewish law, but they changed their minds. And they claimed to have been expelled from the community for saying, number one, the law of Moses was not true. Number two, the soul was not immortal. And three, that there was no God except in the philosophical sense. Now, what's interesting to me is that Spinoza has one obvious place to go, and he doesn't go there. Through the last 1,500 years, when a Jew decided it was not so good to be a Jew anymore, where did they go in Europe? To the church, right? Which was more than happy to welcome them with open arms and usually no questions asked. Spinoza breaks away from the community, and he does not join even the liberal churches which he had an association with, certain sort of Calvinist offshoots who were interested in the sort of philosophical contemplation that he was interested in. He is, in that sense, perhaps the first secular Jew. Right? Because he breaks away from the religious community but does not join another one. And one could argue he's the first sort of ideologically secular European as opposed to sort of circumstantially secular. And if you don't believe that's so, let's see where he goes with it. Right? But in that sense, he makes a choice to become what I like to call a converso of reason. Right? Because he's living a life first amongst the Jews, and then ultimately, even amongst the sort of the Christian community in which he socially embeds himself, where he doesn't really express his full self. There's an inner experience of belief of the world, and again, I'll go back to that model, where he has to either decide that he's wrong, be it that as a sinner, or be it intellectually incorrect, or whatever it is, or he has to re-understand the world within which he's embedded. Most people don't have the intellectual capacity to do that, much less the emotional courage, right? Most people take one of two paths. God forbid they take the path of Oriol de Costa, which is they try to bend themselves, fail, and die, right? Or not everyone actually just, you know, fades out into a part of existence. Many people become passionate advocates of that which they formerly opposed. Right? This is, by the way, my opinion, the explanation of why it is that so many converted Jews were such deep and passionate opponents of Judaism throughout the Middle Ages. Because at a certain point, they broke under this pressure. The whole world around them was telling them, you're wrong, you failed, you missed the boat, and they were unable to live that tension. And then at a certain point, they said, you're right, I'm wrong, I failed, I missed the boat, and they became passionate for that which they were formerly opposed to. Right? There's an important psychology there, but Spinoza, like Einstein and like Avraham before him, instead, he just changes the world. Right? So at first, and again, like I said, the pieces of his biography are almost non-existent, and very interesting. He at this point in his life, he's no longer living as a Jew. He's not part of the Christian community. He's perhaps only in Amsterdam, of all the cities of Europe, that he could have gotten away with such a behavior. He's focused on his philosophy. I told you he wrote this book of Cartesian philosophy, which sort of gave him his entree into the philosophical world. But he's not actually a Cartesian. It's important to remember that, because Descartes, it's well known, he wasn't just the skeptic. Descartes was the classic dualist, right? Right? He had to split the world in half in order to solve his philosophical dilemma. And Spinoza, Jew that he was, does the exact opposite. He will insist, in fact, on the absolute unity of the world, including of God and the world, something which will be known as pantheism. We're going to speak about at the end, but I just want you to understand that though he cut his teeth in Cartesian philosophy, and that's what brought him into the intellectual discourse of his day, and so much so, by the way, that several generations later, Hegel himself would say that to be a follower of Spinoza is essential to the commencement of all philosophy. Right? Spinoza, we as Jews tend to view through the lens of the sort of very small Jewish, argument. There's a better word for that. Dispute, there's something, I don't know, it went in my head now, it doesn't matter. The Jewish thing we always do, you know, right? This argument, but we should appreciate the impact that Spinoza has on modern European philosophy, right? That's on the philosophical world. But actually, what I want to talk about really right now is the impact he has on European culture. Because for circumstances that lay beyond our discussion right now, Amsterdam was having a hard time with tolerance. There was all kinds of political and cultural struggles going on within Amsterdam, and it looked like that sort of Article 13 of the Union of Utrecht was under threat by the rise of a more fundamentalist version of local religion. And the result in Spinoza's life is known as the Theological Political Treatise, right? It was published anonymously in 1670 and has been labeled a book forged in hell, which is great, by the way. You talk about it like, forget the register of the Catholic Church. I mean, you get a book forged in hell, you're made forever. What was it? So it's an extended plea for freedom in the civic realm, freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and most especially freedom to philosophize and pursue whatever religion you want. But on a deeper level, he argues for that freedom by identifying the chief enemies of all freedom as superstition, which is held over the minds of men, coupled to ecclesiastic authority. You know what we call that? Institutional religion. Right? Because he says that he begins the book with a brief history of what he calls the natural history of religion, meaning Christianity and Judaism. This is all he is really interested in, perhaps even know about. And he defines religion as nothing more than organized superstition, right? Grounded not in reason, which as a rational philosopher he sees as the Holy Grail, but rather in the twin passions of hope and fear, right? Hope for material gain and fear of death. Yeah. And we're going to come back to that whole fear of death thing, which looks like we might actually have time. If not today, then certainly next week. So he says, it's a great quote, "Fear engenders, preserves, and fosters superstition. It's the origin of spurious religious observances," right? He goes to town on not only the philosophical underpinnings of organized religion and the prophetic underpinnings. By the way, he's not opposed to the prophetic teachings, but he sees them as tools for the simple, right? Poetic, moral teachings, which for the average person who doesn't understand philosophy are important, but it doesn't make them true, right? He's not opposed to moral teachings. He's just opposed to claiming that they're what God said, right? Because God is a philosophical concept in the mind of Spinoza. But in order to do that, he, I don't think inadvertently, I think deliberately, takes aim at three important things. Number one, he takes aim at a class of people that he calls the priests, right? The people who have a lot to gain from sort of stabilizing and regularizing, I wrote it in my notes, it must be a word, religious practice, right? And he is opposed to anyone who claims authority in the name of God.
That includes the rabbis.
Oh, it certainly includes the rabbis. Remember, in his life, his experience of the rabbis was far more oppressive than his experience of the priests. Now, he was worried about what was happening in Amsterdam as a whole, which was more about the priests than the rabbis, but his immediate experience, he had been excommunicated, for what he thought, not for what he did, as far as we know. As far as we know, right? And I think I agree with the underlying assumption of your question, that if he kept his mouth shut and just hung out in the wrong places, I don't think anybody would have ever done anything. So number one, he takes aim at organized religion. And in order to do that, of course, he takes aim at what he calls a false conception of God, that God is a rational agent. Right? He is, in that respect, a deist. Right? He doesn't believe in revelation. Revelation implies there's God and there's me, and that God is something other than creation, and that God has a rational comprehension which God can then communicate to the human being. You understand? Not buying it, says Spinoza. And last but certainly not least, right, in order to really deal the death blow to this conception of God as a rational agent, Spinoza becomes not the original, but certainly one of the fathers of biblical criticism. Right? We're more familiar with biblical criticism as a product of, say, the German Protestants, or Erasmus, if people are familiar with the humanists of a certain stage of the Catholic Church. But it's Spinoza from within Am Yisrael who first takes systematic aim at the Bible. Right? He, like I said, doesn't dismiss the moral importance of the teachings, but certainly he sees them as fictional stories meant to guide the ignorant masses who can't handle the work of rigorous philosophical proof. Right? The book, not written by Moses. Right? He says there may be a Mosaic core, but they passed through so many hands that they've been completely corrupted. He calls the Bible a mutilated text. Identifies, interestingly enough, Ezra, as we've spoken about long ago, 6th century leader of the Return to Zion, as the final editor of the text of the Bible. Now, once you put a book like that out in 17th century Europe, forget the Jews. What you've just done is stepped in it with the Christians. And that's why I said that it was condemned by every political and religious authority they encountered it all across Europe. Called a book forged in hell. They had to print it anonymously with a false cover, and it was smuggled into various countries. But the fact of the matter is that people were smuggling it. The book had a tremendous impact, right? Because it was one of the first systematic attacks on religion from intellect of this category, and it spread like wildfire. Oh, so I have that in my notes elsewhere. Big risk. There was this printer in Amsterdam who basically specialized in what we would say sort of offset printing. it's like I'll print your book. We'll think of a fake name and a fake cover. And you'll get it out there, and then we'll also put a fake publisher on there because, you know, there's a whole story. It's a great book called A Book Forged in Hell, by the way, on the theological political treatise. It's highly worth reading.
It's very readable and short.
Yeah, it's not long. Yeah, it's an interesting thought. It's an interesting thought. And again, it goes to the heart of the question, is that whether he's right or not, and the theological political treatise. Yeah.
So is Spinoza a deist or an atheist?
So we're going to get there. I'm going to get to his last word. I'm almost there. But I do want to say on that note that Spinoza was fighting a battle for freedom. And as we say, all is fair in love and war. Right? But there's a question that needs to be asked, which is all knowledge good? Right? Meaning, knowledge in service of freedom, I think most of us would agree, coming from the culture that we come from, is at least a legitimate tool. But what happens when you already have freedom? Because there are other values that come to play. And Spinoza is part of creating a world in which the hope, inspiration, morality, and guidance which were provided by tradition are decimated. Right? What world emerges out of that is a very important question, which then poses the question to those of us who live in a world of freedom, by and large, the people sitting in this room, we live in a world of freedom, right? What role does such skepticism and deconstruction play in our own thoughts? Meaning, is it always so good to know? Right? Or are there things which are better to receive and remain unquestioned? I would even go further. Is there a type of knowledge, as Ruff Cook says, which is lost by having too broad a thought? Or as my father used to say, Aleph Shalom, it's good to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. right? So there's a question there which really lies further ahead in our discussion. We're going to get back to it with Mendelssohn, but before I set up Baruch Spinoza as the great hero of freedom, just remember that he undermined many things in his quest to free largely himself, but also the society around him. So last thing, the question, was he a deist? So Spinoza's great work of philosophy is known as The Ethics, and it was published posthumously. That means after his death, right? And in it, I mean, I don't claim to understand the ethics. I've opened it. It made no sense to me. I shut it almost immediately afterwards. But in reading sort of secondary texts about it, the two elements I think that are critical to understand is, first of all, Spinoza is really, if you want to put a label on him, a pantheist. A pantheist, which means what? Right? The famous phrase that he has, and I can't say it in Latin, is God or nature. Meaning, doesn't mean either or, means same, same. That there is no creation and creator, which is a classic pillar of sort of medieval theology. There's creator and created, and on some level, never the two shall meet. Right? That's one of the mysteries of Revelation. It's a bridge. And as we go, by the way, further into the story of modernity, I don't know how far we'll get, but it speaks to a lot of the tensions in religious thought which exist today. But he doesn't believe that there is God and nature. He says, the eternal and infinite being we call God or nature acts from the same necessity from which he exists. And that's the other thing, is that all existence is deterministic. Right? He was in, remember I told you that his work on Descartes was a geometric proof. Right? And that's the same way the ethics is presented in Euclidean proofs. Right? Postulate, axiom, theory, right? And you can't argue with that, right? You ever argue with your geometry teacher? You're always wrong, right? You just didn't understand, right? Because it's a sort of a closed system of logic. You either get it or you don't. And that's the same way the ethics presents itself. However, there is one sort of door left open, which is very interesting in his thought, right? Pantheism, by the way, as a word, doesn't exist in his time. It's a word coined afterwards, and it's put on him. He does say there's only one substance, right? He's very into the oneness, which, of course, is very Jewish. And if you look in the fifth book of the Ethics, which he sees as the sort of essence of the work, he leaves a way open for what we might call salvation and even the eternity of the soul. Right? Because unlike his contemporaries, Spinoza never really gave up on the absolute spiritual goals of mystics, right? But he just believed that reason was the way to get there. He was what we would call a philosophical mystic, because his rationality was what he called scientia intuitivi. It's not just analytical or descriptive of the world, but it's holistic comprehension that can offer what he calls an unmediated knowledge of God or nature. By the way, if we start speaking about an unmediated knowledge of God or nature, what's the word for that in traditional Judaism? Well, it's prophecy. It's prophecy. And so once again, Spinoza is a product of the problem which his era has produced, which is that when you have a breakdown in tradition as a source of authority, right? Because in his experience, tradition was forcing him to continue the life of a converso, that his inner experience did not match the world as it was presenting itself. And because he, in the power of his intellect, was unwilling to either judge himself as wrong or to bow to the world outside of himself, which in many ways functions the same thing, unless, God forbid, it was an act of self-destruction, right? He instead changed the world. And he said, no, there's only one source of authority. And that is this strange combination of the empirical and the rational, this scientific intuition which allows you an unmediated experience of the wholeness of creation. Right? Because creation is, God is not something other than. So he says the wholeness of God as well. Right? This is a lot of philosophical thought which may be above all of our heads. But you should understand the impact that the ethics will have on an entire generation of what we will ultimately call maskilim, these young Jewish enlighteners, who on one hand were deeply Jewish and therefore felt an allegiance to their tradition and even a desire for this sort of spiritual power that many of them had tasted. Because as we'll speak about, you know where a lot of the Eastern European in particular, where a lot of those Eastern European enlighteners began their quest? In Chassidut, right? In a desire for some spiritual experience. For various reasons, as we'll speak about, they didn't find it there. But many of them, the next step was Spinoza. Because in his mind, reason actually offers a pathway not just to freedom, but to revelation, to salvation, but just not in the way that tradition had packaged it. So that's a picture of Spinoza, the first secular Jew, perhaps, and certainly one of the fathers of the Enlightenment. I'm going to pause there, questions, comments, and then maybe what we'll do is we'll knock out the story of Emden Ibeshitz as a setup for the next phase to come. Uriel da Costa? Either Acosta or da Costa, it's written a couple of ways in the literature. Da, is it D-A? Thank you. You're welcome. Salvation? It's an unmediated experience, unmediated knowledge of God. By the way, somebody already said it. Who else saw? Yeah, this is classic Maimonian thought. The Rambam said that the whole purpose of creation is to know God. And he was in good company in that sense. And so Spinoza rejects what he sees as all the falsehoods of institutionalized religion, but not what at least some of our tradition sees as its goal. And this is another question that modernity will pose, is that are you able to identify the goal and strip away the structures that have always claimed to be oriented toward reaching it? Does that work? I'm not asking if you're allowed. That's not the question. Well, because modernity doesn't ask whether you're allowed. It only asks whether it works. And renaming. It's a relabel. There's a rebranding. You know, if you ever thought that rebranding was a powerful tool, if you can do it to the Inquisition, you can do it to anything. Anything else? Other questions or comments? Thank you for that, Chuck. Okay. No? So we have about 15, 18 minutes left here. Now I got to that point where I told you I didn't know what I was going to do. I don't really know what to do either. But I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story in lack of a better term. One morning in the city of Frankfurt in 1725, agents of the rabbinic authorities of the city, which, by the way, says a lot about the nature of rabbinic authority, that it has agents, they stopped one Moshe Meir of Kamenka, or accosted, I should say, since he was asleep in his hotel. And they searched his possessions, and in his bags they found a stack of Sabbatean writings. Now, under questioning, Mr. Mayer revealed that he was indeed what was known as a Sabbatean emissary. He'd set out from a place called Podolia earlier to make contact with what proved to be quite an extensive network of Sabbatean enthusiasts in Frankfurt, which was then subsequently, as we say, rolled up by the rabbinic authorities. Now, among his manuscripts were a number of works. One of them known as, Vavo Hayom El Ha'ayin, I will go today to the spring, which was sort of a deep analysis of Sabbatean Kabbalah. And even though there was no title on it, the evidence seemed to point to a major German scholar of the name of Rabbi Yonatan Ibeshitz. Now, Rabbi Yonatan Ibeshitz was indeed, as I said, a major scholar of his day, and this led to a huge scandal erupting in Frankfurt. You're talking about a pillar of the rabbinic establishment who was suddenly accused of being a secret Sabbatean. Now, he got out of it this time. But before we go on with the story, I just want to point out a few of the details and all the implications of it. Rabbinic agents stopping people, searching their bags, rolling up networks of Sabbatean enthusiasts? What is going on in the early 18th century in Am Yisrael. Remember, that Shabtai Tzvi converted at this point 60 years ago. And as I pointed out to you, the Sabbatean movement didn't fade. It didn't even just peter along. It grew. And it grew as an underground movement. And it created a sense of paranoia throughout the religious establishment. Because remember that moment I described to you? So, Rabbi, what about your Messiah now? Right? The answer for many of those rabbinic authorities was, I don't know, I guess we were wrong. The answer for many of them were, no, we're not wrong. Because Nathan of Gaza is still out there explaining how this is actually a fulfillment of all the prophecies about Shabtai Tzvi. And others were just confused. Right? And so what began to happen is an underground network of enthusiasts, prophets, teachers, right? Kabbalistic writings being passed hand-to-hand in manuscripts began to spread throughout Europe, which in the parallel meant that the standard rabbinic establishment was consumed by paranoia. And everybody's enemy became a Sabbatean. Right? The accusation of the author of the Yerot Davash, of Rav Eibshitz, his reputation sort of slowed any action against them, and he quickly joined amongst the rabbis of the city of Frankfurt, who put a ban on Sabbateanism, and it quieted things down for almost 25 years. But 25 years later or so, another controversy erupted. In 1751, Rav Eibshitz was appointed chief rabbi of the communities of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, right? That ultimate coveted position of a secure rabbinate. However, he had a contemporary who didn't trust him, and that was Rav Yaakov Emden, known as the Yavitz. Now, the Yavitz was very interesting. He was the son of the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi had been the chief rabbi of Amsterdam in the early 18th century. And the Yavitz was a traditionalist, even in an age where the Jews were getting more traditional, or at least the rabbinic class was getting more traditional. But at the same time, he knew Hebrew grammar, he learned German, Dutch, Latin, and he was considered one of the most critical thinkers of his age. Interestingly enough, he was one of the last major rabbinic authorities to take a stand against the Zohar. Right? The Yavitz, Rav Yaakov Emden, did not believe that the Zohar had been written by Shimon Bar Yochai. He believed it had been written at a much later date. And he was pretty much alone in that respect. I mean, today, for an Orthodox rabbi to get up and say that the Zohar wasn't written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would be, I don't know what to compare it to, but it would be a mess. It would be a mess. But he held it out, and largely motivated by the fact that the Zohar, of course, was the intellectual bastion of the Sabbateans, right? He also, by the way, just to give you some context, claimed that the Guide for the Perplexed, Maimonides' book, contained heretical thoughts and therefore couldn't have been written by Maimonides. So again, critical thinkers can take their oversteps as well. Not that you have to agree with them, but to claim that therefore it couldn't have been written by Maimonides. Right, this is, by the way, the origin of what many people consider to be the two Rambam theory. Like, the real Rambam is the Mishnah Torah, his halachic work, and this other one was not really him. I think that sort of just undervalues the complexity of human thought. But in 1751, just after Rav Eibshitz had become rabbi in these three communities, there was an accusation that came that several of the amulets that he had written were actually Sabbatean amulets. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but again, context. Amulets? Right? This is 1751. Right? Europe at this point is rapidly moving toward sort of philosophical skepticism, not just rationalism. And the Jews are writing amulets to solve their problems. Your problems in love, your problems in finance, your problems in health. Now, that doesn't mean that that's all they're doing, but this is a well-accepted practice all the way from back in the time of the Gemara. And it's got a lot of history behind it. But the controversy over these amulets erupted throughout European Jewry. There's so much detail here, but it ultimately, what happened though, because the position that Rav Eibshitz held was a government position, right? In Germany, the religious community was a governmental function. Therefore, the struggle between he and Rav Emden left the realms of rabbinic authority and ended up in this, what we would today call the civil courts. So the Hamburg City Council, right, backed Rav Eibshitz, because he was the head of this triple community, Hamburg, Altona, and Wandsbek, right? But the reality is that the Middle Ages hadn't entirely disappeared, because Altona was legally a province of Denmark, And the Altona City Council didn't want to get involved, not like the Hamburg Oil, so they brought the dispute to the King of Denmark. Now, the reason this matters for us is that, by the way, there had been a complete breakdown. There was violence in the streets. The supporters of Rob Emden, the supporters of Rob Ijits were literally fighting in the streets. I'm not just talking about like writing letters to each other. But what we have here is suddenly, not really overnight, but let's just say fairly quickly, this dispute becomes hugely public. And therefore the king demands that Rob Ijits appear before him in the court in Copenhagen and explain the whole thing. Right? Ijits makes an interesting choice. And he chooses as his lawyer his former student, Carl Anton. Now you think, former student, he's a lawyer, that's great. Except Carl Anton was born as Gershon Moshe Cohen. But after studying with Ijits in yeshiva, he converted to Christianity, changed his name, and became a professor of Hebrew at Helmstedt University. Right? I mean, he was an excellent choice in terms of his defense. On one hand, he knew the topic. On the other hand, he was a well-respected professor. On the other hand, if you're trying to argue for your stance on traditional Judaism, and one of your chief students, who is now a Christian convert, is your lawyer, you're perhaps undermining your position. Now, it turns out that in court, everybody claimed victory, but Rav Ijits was immediately exonerated, right? However, there was a further breakdown because Rav Emden did not give up. He was trying to rally the Jewish masses against Sabbateanism. Now, I'm going through this quickly because I decided that it's not a critical story, but this is what I want you to understand. The controversy raged on. I'm looking at my notes here and deciding what's important, what's not. Sorry. There's actually a book, hundreds of rabbis who signed letters of support for Rav Ijits. It's called Luchot Eidut, right? The controversy seemed to have died down. If you look at the record of it, this thing keeps going and coming. By the way, this is comparable, Lahavdil, but it's comparable to the McCarthy trials. Like this idea that once you call someone a Sabbatean, the burden of proof is on them. So on one hand, there were many people who were very afraid of the Sabbateans and they wanted to persecute Rav Ijits. On the other hand, there were people who were logical enough to know that like this is just an excuse for rabbinic power struggle, right? Now, however, what happens? The controversy had died down. In 1760, Rav Ijits' younger son, Wolf, interesting name, right? Declared himself a Sabbatean prophet, right? Gathered some remnants of Rav Ijits' yeshiva and began preaching in town. The yeshiva closed down, needless to say, right? And the controversy didn't even end with Rav Ijits' death. Right? Because Rav Yaakov Emden continued to publish his attacks, and he died in 1764. After his son became a Sabbatean prophet. Although, interestingly enough, the two of them are buried. He and Rav Ijits and Rav Emden are buried almost next to each other.
What city
were buried? I didn't write it down, come on. I have to look it up. I can't believe I didn't write that down. I wrote down a sentence. I can see I broke it off. There's no period at the end of it. This is just culling from my notes. So there's a couple of things that we need to take from this. First of all, the impact of the Sabbatean heresy, right, grew rather than shrinking. That's like interesting, say, sociological phenomenon, and it begs a question, which we're going to have to come back to in perhaps a class to come, which is what was the need that was being met? And as I pointed out to you guys, that fighting the symptom may be useful on a sociological plane, but people who are such enthusiasts had some real need. And if you can't actually figure out what the cause is, what the need is, then that need will be met one way or another. But what's more important to me is that the very public nature of this struggle is seen by many historians as one of the final blows to widespread rabbinic authority, right? I mean, you know, authority sort of is what it does, right? Now, there's a difference between authority and power in that respect, meaning a policeman might not have any authority in your eyes, but if they have a gun, a badge, and a stick, they can exercise power whether they have authority or not. But, of course, what happens with the brutal exercise of power is that it ultimately undermines the authority of the institutions which it attempts to support, right? Because you may think that the law has authority as an abstract, but you don't trust the police. Well, the reality is, the more interactions that you have that are negative with the police, the less you will come to believe that the law is just, and it loses its authority. You understand? So therefore, the rabbinic class represents the one hand power. Remember the rabbinic agents that are rifling through this guy's stuff and finding, by the way, what they were looking for. Let's not forget that, right? That's an exercise of power, right? But suddenly, when those rabbis are engaged, two major rabbis, and people learn the books of Rav Eibshitz to this very day. You can find Yarot Devash. It's a big controversy. By the way, you go on the internet, people are still arguing about whether he was a Sabbatean, even after his son became a prophet. I don't know. But the public struggle, and in particular, the going to the secular authorities, just raised a lot of questions in the minds of the average Jew who was exposed to this struggle about whether the rabbis are actually attempting to wield power or whether they represent authority, right? And as a last little comment here in the last couple of minutes, an interesting side note that in the spring of 1761, a young traveler appeared at the home of Rabbi Yonatan Eibshitz. And this was the young Moshe Mendelssohn. At this point in his life, he gained enough Talmudic mastery that he was trying to get the title of Morenu, our teacher. It's a basic level of smicha, of ordination. And he turned to Rabbi Eibshitz in his capacity as the chief rabbi of this triple community, and because of his status, despite any controversy, which we were certainly aware of. And, you know, from all accounts, Rabbi Eibshitz was very impressed. He tested him. He was amazed by both the depth of his Talmudic knowledge and his base in science and philosophy, right? He even apparently said, you know, for Moses, his hands are heavy and his ability great, right? Hands are heavy is the reference to Moshe from the Bible, right? But it was no dice. Rabbi Eibshitz didn't want to give the title of rabbi to a Jewish philosopher who was writing in German and participating in the literary debates of German intellectual society of his day, right? And in the end, he gave him a letter of recommendation filled with praise, but not a title, right? Now, we're going to pursue next week this role that Moses Mendelssohn plays in the Jewish Enlightenment. But I want you, when we do, to see him walking out of Rav Eibshitz's study, you know, having sought what? Smicha, which means looking for the authority that comes from tradition. Right? Looking for the authority that comes from tradition from somewhere at this point that there was a growing experience amongst Am Yisrael that it was from a failed institution. Now, it's a little bit over-dramatizing because, I mean, as a rabbi myself, right, there are still a lot of rabbis out there. Nevertheless, one of the hallmarks of modernity and certainly post-modernity is the erosion of the institution of rabbis as authority figures. I wonder how many of you think of rabbis as authority figures and how many of you think of them as educators, right? In my opinion, if there's any hope for the rabbinate in the future, it's as educators, not as authority figures, which is, of course, how it began, right? But here you live in we're looking at an era where the Emden Eibshitz controversy really marks the high point of the attempt for rabbis to maintain their status as authority figures, and in the conflict with all the forces of modernity, which are undermining traditional authority altogether, and here in his study appears Moses Mendelssohn, who intellectually will do much to finish that job. So we're going to stop there. We will pick up with the story of what is enlightenment in the next class.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.